What's up, Bounce Back Nation? I'm so excited to be a community with you again. This is your girl, Deanna Chase Speaks, and I'm in a different space today, as you'll figure out why as we go through this podcast. So for most of you, or well, not say most, maybe some, right? Some of you may be aware that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and I really kind of grapple with putting out an episode about domestic violence. And really, it's because I struggle with it for a couple of different reasons. One, because I'd rather talk about it as it genuinely comes up and it genuinely like is something that I see people struggling with in my coaching, or like I'm coming into articles and things and letting it like kind of naturally evolve from just, you know, intersecting with life and seeing where this is something where resilience may need to be discussed. And so I was feeling a kind of way about doing an episode because I'm like, is this naturally occurring? But at the end of the day, even though it's like a designated month and a designated time, it came about for a reason. And we know that there is a time and a season for everything under the sun, right? So if this is the time and the season that the world really stops and pays attention, then I feel like, you know what, let me just go ahead and do it. So today's show is really just talking through how to be an ally to someone who is really trying to survive a domestic violence situation. And I'm coming from that space, not just as a podcaster, not just as a former caseworker, not just as a former foster youth, all of the things, not just as a woman, but as a survivor. So I did a show last year that really talked about just the experiences around domestic violence, but it wasn't my story, it was mine. It wasn't my story, it was someone else's. And I just kind of talked to it with her, and I had some requests to share a little bit more about my story, and it kind of makes sense, right? I'm looking at my team, you know, and they're like nodding like you should totally do it. And I really hesitated for a couple of reasons. One is that I know that it's always a difficult place to go back and think about certain things. And like, even if you've overcome it, sometimes you can't really tell when you will have an effect and when it won't. And so much of my job revolves around either the retelling of my story, informing from my story, even though sometimes I feel like that doesn't hold as much weight with the people listening as it should. And then even, you know, helping others on their journey, whether it's cultivating resilience or just talking someone through like a rough day. So, and then my kids also went through this with me, and I don't ever want to do anything that re-traumatizes them and makes it harder for them to, you know, go about their day because they've heard something or listened to something and they're, you know, part of my team that could upset them, you know, make it harder for them to do what they do. And I started to put it out like it was scheduled originally to come out one time, and I kept kicking it. So by the time this episode is probably aired, it'll probably be November, and that's okay. I'm still just going to go ahead and talk from that space and just kind of hope that it's still a blessing and it's still able to inform how, you know, you all are allies to those around you. If you're a provider, how you can be a better ally from your space and your place in that person's life. And side note, I feel like my chair is creaking a lot. Do you guys hear it? Like, listeners, if you hear it, just say in there, like, girl, yeah, we heard the chair. Because we're looking for better chairs, but just wanting something comfortable. Because we've learned just because you pay $200, $300, $400 doesn't mean it's comfortable. Anyway, so I want to give a brief synopsis about my story. And then we're going to talk about being an ally for those with domestic violence. So my story, I was in my 20s. I want to say I was maybe 20 years old. Obviously, it's really easy to just blame everything on foster care, like you came out of it and you weren't healed, and that was certainly true. But I think in my story also, I think that there were red flags there that I didn't pick up on. Now I know at 42, oh, that's a red flag. I'm not even getting ready to deal. But at 20, because I was broken, right? And not just because of foster care, but just other things that had happened to me and I hadn't really healed. I hadn't healed to a place where I could better assess the situation and entering into a relationship with this person. And so when I met them, I was living on my own and I was just kind of the spot where people came to kick it, right? Because you know, when you're in foster care, you, when you go through something, you just kind of find each other. You find people that have similar experiences, similar backgrounds, and it makes sense that you would, you know, end up connecting with them. And so this person came into my life. He was a friend of my brother's and we would play Monopoly. We would play spades. And I was in college. That's kind of what we did. I wasn't really a drinker or a smoker or anything like that. But for those that did around me, it was like a safe place. We didn't have to be in the clubs. We didn't have to be in the streets. And I had control over who came in my house, right? So, but I could still, you know, cared about the people and wanted them to be okay. This was my rationale in my mind. And so, you know, we're kicking it. And one day, you know, my brother brings over this guy and it's his friend. And, you know, it kind of goes from there. And we ended up, like, before I knew it, he had moved in. And, you know, it's like as soon as we were together, we moved in. And that's like such a young woman's mistake, such a broken woman's mistake, if I can be honest. I'm just talking about me. Maybe y'all's situation looks a little different, but I'm just going to talk about mine. And, yeah, and so as it kind of got off, you know, as we're familiar with now, the love bombing was in full effect. I mean, it would be, he found out my favorite perfume was Heavenly, still rock with it to this day. Yeah, I don't care what y'all say. It's still amazing. And still rocking with it to this day. And so he found out he got the biggest set that they had and he got like two or three of them. And then there were teddy bears and cards that were 3 feet tall and, you know, cleaned, you know, like my dresser, moved off my perfumes and other things and made it look so beautiful. And I'm a candle person. So, you know, there were candles there too. And I was like, oh my God, you know, because I'm when it comes to love languages, I feel like I'm tied between two. And I know you're not supposed to say that, but it's my show. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. And so acts of service is a big thing for me. And so it wasn't necessarily the money. It was the thought behind it. It was, you know, the fact that it was something I really liked and it was beautiful and, you know, all that type of thing. So, you know, he asked me to go with him. I said yes. And then, you know, we were together and it was very, very intense. And we didn't have sex for 8 months. So you guys was just whooped or sprung on each other. It was like, no, we genuinely didn't have sex for 8 months. Even my friends around us were like, dude, what is happening? Like, what is going on? And so we really were just getting to know each other. And I think we found each other at a time, looking back, where we each were broken in different ways and had our own things going on. And so there was a lot of trauma bonding that was the foundation for the relationship. And when I tried to get out early, which I know now that this is like part of the abuse and the control, is he talked about suicide. He talked about killing himself and not wanting to live and things like that. And I just couldn't bear that. And I asked him, I said, well, yo, like, what would make you want to take your own life? And it's so ironic because that's something that I had thought about, but I felt like the stuff that I had endured and been made to do and was, you know, what it was like, I just didn't want to hurt anymore. But I was curious if that was his perspective. And I asked him and he had told me all these things. And I later learned that some of them were lies. And he told me about his parents and his siblings and things and how hard it was and how he was different and how, you know, it was just difficult. And looking back, I'm like, oh my God, the red flags were waving so loud. They probably had the sound of cacophony right? Some instrument that's like, hello, over here. You know, it was really obvious, glaringly obvious now. But I'm just being transparent in the hopes that, you know, it's helpful. Honestly, that's really what it is. And so before you know it, you know, he was really enmeshed in my life. You know, we went everywhere together. Every time I had a family function, because I didn't miss those, you know, he was there. He knew my family. You know, when we went shopping, we had Kroger's. I mean, we were just always together. And then one day we got into an argument because I tried to leave. And that was the first time I think I was hit. And from then on, the relationship started to change. He started to be more open with his addiction to alcohol, his stealing. I mean, it started to get really bad. And every time I would try to leave, I couldn't leave. And so I just endured. You know what I mean? I just made sure my kids were safe. I felt like they were out of range so that it wouldn't be as bad. And I rationalized that because I knew that if anything happened to my kids, I was going to jail. Okay. So I knew the city would burn. And I'm like, he's not worth it. If I can just try to separate and keep them safe, then that's what I was going to try to do. And so one day we were arguing and I'm like, you know, I really just told him about himself. I was so mad I got calm. And I don't know if that made him like, yo, what's going on? I don't know. I can't call what she's about to do. Or like, I don't know what was going through his mind. But yeah, he got really calm. And I just simply said like, you know, I don't want to have to ask you for the rent money. I don't want to have to ask you for food money. And it wasn't that he wasn't giving it to me. It was the fact that I had to ask you, like, you knew you walked in here and expected to see food. Like, what part of how you grew up is like, you don't have to pay where you pay as you weigh. Like, even in the street, you pay as you weigh, you get how you live. Like, where do you come off trying to come here and live off of this woman and her two kids? And so that was so offensive to him that I thought I was going to get hit, but I didn't. But so then he tried to, you know, get it straight and everything was going good for a while. And then I really, really got back into church and I'm like, you know, I don't want to be with someone that steals. Like, let me just go ahead and, like, if you can't do that, then you're going to have to leave. And I started to put my foot down around the things that I expected, about the things I deserved, about the things that I wanted. And that was always a sore spot. When you were holding him accountable, when you were establishing a boundary, you know, when you were establishing a boundary, it was always like a big blow up for him. And so, you know, we kind of had blown up and it kept, you know, and we were cyclical, right? I would call the police. I would, you know, and so one day it really clicked for me when I talked to his mom and she was like, well, you can't be buying his clothes, his shoes and da da da. And I was so offended. Like, what do you mean buy his clothes? I've never bought that man a thing in my life. Not in terms of clothes and shoes. If I wanted him to get a present, yes, but he would always come in with new stuff, but he stole. You know what I mean? He would go to thrift stores. He would steal DVDs and sell them or whatever. And so I'm like, I don't do that for your son. And that really made me realize like, okay, so then now he's probably playing two hands against the middle. I got to get out. So I broke up with him, told him it was over. And he wouldn't leave because he said, well, I don't have anywhere to go, so I'm not leaving. I'm like, okay, but that doesn't matter to me. And I tried to just like, we can be roommates. I'll give you till X date, but you have to go. And so then to try to punish me, he was like, now I'm not paying you anything. That's fine. But now you really made it clear that you have to leave. And that didn't work. So I went to CMHA and I went over there and talked to her. And that was a whole other situation. But I'm sitting in her office and she looked at me and she just felt sympathy for me. At least that's how it looked. And she said, baby, if I kick you out, I gotta kick him. If I kick him out, I gotta kick you out too. I said, what? Why? He's not on the lease. She said, yeah, he's not on the lease. You shouldn't have had him in there. And so I was like, well, I didn't know. And she's like, well, now you know. And so when they came back, I came back and he was laying on the couch and it was like he knew. And so from then on, it was just like tension because now it's like, you're really thinking you about to sit in here and be in my face and I'm gonna be okay with it. I'm not. And so we were arguing and he said something and I said, bruh, go to hell. And he threw a plate at my head and it almost hit me. And I turned around and he ran in the around this wall from my kitchenette, because, you know, in the hood, you don't have big kitchens. So he ran around the wall and ran in my face. And instantly I heard my kids scream. And, you know, the sheer fear of that, I feel like was hard. And even just, you know, I'm just not going to recall that part. But so he's in my face and he's like, "You act like you're not scared of me." And I said, "I'm not scared of you." And that's the problem. You want me to be scared of you, and I don't have the capacity. I grew up with the mom I grew up with, okay? In the neighborhood I grew up with, you do not frighten me. I know that she'll probably throw me around this room 2 days from Sunday, but I'm not going. So I don't know what you want me to do. And he poked me in my forehead, and that's all it took. Next thing you know, I'm swinging. He bear hugs me, throws me into a wall. And it were kind of, you know, he's like trying to calm me down because my kids are there screaming. And I didn't even hear them because I was enraged. I had had so much pent up anger. And it was at this day, I'm like, that's it. I got to get out of here. And so eventually he leaves. You know, it gets really, really bad. And one day he comes over later on, because he comes back with the same sob story about his family. He's the black sheep. They never loved him. They never wanted him. And his mom looked him in the face and told him, you know, she didn't want him and all these things. And I felt bad because my mom has said such hurtful things to me that I didn't want him to hurt. But that had lost its grip. And so I was like, "Well, you have to leave." He's like, "Well, I'll wait here till you get back." I'm like, "Nope, you have to leave." I'm like, "I can take you wherever you want to go, but you have to go." And my mom was there. And so I thought that because my mom was there, he would be chill, but he wasn't. And I haven't really talked too much about my mom, but if you've ever heard me speak, you know I'm honest in that she ain't go. Okay, whatever you thought was about to go, she wasn't about to do it. She don't play about her kids, and she also wasn't scared of anybody. And so I always try to keep my mom out of it, because I didn't want to have him do anything to my mom, because that's still my mom. Okay, and in that regard, I'm not going. And so we get in the car and I'm driving and I let my mom out and I circle the block because she's going to a drugstore like where it was downtown. You know, I had to circle. And he was like, he pulled out a box cutter and he said, "I should just cut your face right now. I should just cut you right now," something like that. And I didn't say anything. He's like, "Yeah, you're scared. You're quiet." And I'm like, "I'm quiet because I don't want it to escalate. My mom about to get back in the car. Like, it's not even that serious." And then so my mom gets in the car. She's making jokes and I'm not responding. I'm just driving. And my mom's like, "Ugh, what's wrong with you?" And I'm just like, "Nothing, mom. I'm good. Like, just sit back. It's good." And so he was like, "So you really done? You really done?" I'm like, "Yes." And he's like, "Don't think I won't go off because your mom's in the car." Now mom's ears are perking up. And so she's like, "What's going on?" And so I was supposed to take him somewhere. I ended up trying to get to where I could get him out safely. And, you know, I skipped the step. So when my mom went in after he pulled the box cutter out and he put it away, we started to fight. So we're on a main high street downtown. The car is in the turn lane and in the straight lane, and we're fighting in this car. And so afterwards, I'm like, "Bruh." So after we like fight and we tussle, and I'm like, "Get out of my car right now." He's like, "I'm not getting out. I'm like, you need to chill because I got to get my mom." And right after that, my mom got in the car. And so after, you know, we're talking and we're moving forward or whatever, my mom looks at me and she said, "Dina, what's wrong with your face?" And I heard in her voice that it was about to go up. Okay. She's not having it. I'm like, "It's good." We finally get to the corner store and she's like, "I'm calling the police." I said, "Mom, just call the police. Like, please don't say anything, because that's going to escalate this to a whole other level. Please don't say anything. Just go get out the car." So she goes, she calls the police. She's talking stuff to him the entire way. And I'm like, "Quit talking to my mom like that." He gets out the car. And when he reaches, so we fight in the car. So he goes to get out. He, like, I don't know if he elbowed me or he punched me. And so we're fighting. And then he kicks in the car. He throws a soap bottle. It was like a full Old Spice bottle. And it breaks my rearview mirror, splashes all over my car, ruined one of my better shirts, blouses, okay? And I realized that my earring, my metal earring, because I always loved these funky earrings, was stuck in my ear. And I was just like, my face was burning. I was messed up. And I saw the police come up. And at this point, my mom is hysteric because she comes right around the corner as the police pull up. So at this point, she's full-fledged. Now, my mom is 5'4". She said she was 5'5". And I'll be trying to give her that inch when she was alive. But we're going to be honest because she's with the Lord. So she was 5'5", 4". This dude easily was 300 pounds. And she took off running toward him to try to get to him. And I'm standing there. And I'm looking down. And my shirt was light blue. And it was covered in blood. And it was mainly from my ear, from the metal being lodged. And so they took their pictures. And I said, you know, I knew better. And I was starting to blame myself. And she said, there is no excuse. And the police officer that was talking to me, there's no excuse. There's no excuse. And I'm just sitting here trying to process it. And I take my mom, or they take her home or whatever. And I get in the car and I'm just quiet. I'm just riding home. And I had a sense of peace because he went to jail. And I knew that it was over for me. And so I did that. And I got home and I had my sister, who was at my house at the time, send my kids upstairs. So we go in the kitchen and she's like livid. And I hadn't really told my family. I tried to keep it from them because if you touch my mom or my siblings or my kids, I have zero tolerance. It's a 0 to 100 response most times. And I didn't want them to get involved. And this is the first time I think my sister really knew what was going on. And so I didn't go to work the next day because I was sore. I had a goose egg on my right side of my chin. My left cheek was busted. My ear had a gash across the whole top of it because I had a long earring and it had metal turns and that's what was embedded in my ear. And I had a black eye and I had a mark on my forehead. And I don't even know where the mark on the forehead came from. But I had to heal from that enough to go to work. And I called my coworkers, who I was a caseworker at the time. And I was like, yo, I can't come to work today. I told him everything that was going on, but I don't want Tony in my business, but I don't know what to tell her. And Tony was my supervisor at the time. And, you know, they handled it, praise God. And eventually I got back to work and I was slow going. They kind of helped me cover because I was sore. My body was sore, right? I'd been into a fight and been hit and kicked. And I just knew that I had to still see my kids, but it was just rough. And so when I went to court, I do it. And this is where the allyship starts to really come into play. From a provider space, because I clearly am skimming because A, I don't want this to be triggering. B, I don't want it to focus on solely on the abuse. And just C, I don't want the show to be just long, you know. But when I went to speak with the advocates, they couldn't have cared less. And that was so hurtful because you're asking me to recount something that the literal wounds are so fresh, you can see them. The other wounds are so present, I am holding them, I am feeling them, and you are not even giving me eye contact, you're not looking at me, you couldn't care less. Then my advocate gave me the wrong date, so I came for the initial hearing, right? And his mom was there, and she was like, you need to press charges so he doesn't do this again, which, side note, is ironic because to this day, she acts like she doesn't know me and is like angry with me like I did this to her son. Like, if that's how you want to feel, I'm totally fine with that. But it's just weird. And so, you know, the second date, I was supposed to go. They gave me the wrong date. And so he went earlier and got released. And I was so depressed for weeks because I did not want another woman to go through that and not know what he had done to me. If you had given that guy a chance after, you know, that's one thing. If you saw that and read that and then you gave him a chance, okay. But now I'm like, oh my God, no one will ever know. And I was like so upset about it. And so I just started to kind of heal and tried to find like supportive services and things like that. And there weren't very many. If you weren't actively in an abusive situation, there wasn't very many. And so that was hurtful in and of itself. But years later, you know, because I would see him, and even though I wasn't afraid, or at least consciously afraid, I would avoid him. I would go the other way. And so I was talking to my best friend. I said, I don't want to be afraid of this dude. Like, I don't want to feel like he has control over me anymore. And I said, so from now on, when I see him, I'm going to give him eye contact. I am not going to move. And it was almost as if God was like, okay, hold my beer. We're going to test that, my child, and see. And I would see him at the library by my house. I would see him, you know, in places where he shouldn't be. Like, I had bought a house for, I even tried to act like I was cool enough with him to, like, let bygones be bygones, and even had him at my house. And I just couldn't do it. And I was like, you know, I thought I could do this. I just can't do this. And so we would talk on Facebook, and I was never impolite, but I just couldn't resume any level of friendship because the damage had been done, right? But he had offered to come to my graduation. I graduated in 2018 with my master's, praise God. And he was like, I want to be there, you know, because he's really was trying to make up for being such an asshole while we were together. And I'm like, okay, you know what? It's cool. And when I said it, and I was like, oh, when Ezekiel might come, and my family, who had really started to find, because even my sister knew, but I didn't really disclose anything because I just wanted to get past it. And so my family, who extended family, are just now finding out. And so they're like, yeah, we hope he come. And I'm like, listen, I don't want that at my graduation because this ain't about him and it's not about you. Loudly as it's kept, okay? I don't even want to deal with that. I want to walk. I want it to be peaceful and I want to go home. And so I reached out to him and said, hey, you know, my family just kind of really found out what happened between us. I don't think it's wise if you come. You know, I just, can we just like connect some other time? And he said, you know what? Your family, you and your family never gonna forgive me for that. And I'm done trying. And it's like, bro, first of all, you ain't try. Like, you reached out and we talked on Facebook. If that's effort, then you can keep it. Like, if I'd have known that's what this was, you know, I was almost pissed. Like, you can't make up for that. I'm not looking for you to make up for that, right? That was never my expectation. And so, you know, then it kind of went on from there. And at that point, even when we see each other, it's like no speaking, no words, and that's fine. Like, it's cool. But when you think about, or when I think about how many resources and supposed allies that I came in contact with that were supposed to help me could not care less, was so upsetting. And so if you're listening to this and you are a provider, that means you're paid to be an advocate or an ally for someone coming through this space. If you really don't care, please get out the position. Just go ahead and vacate the position. There's other things you can do for money. And I know I've stayed in jobs for money, you know, or because I didn't take care of my family. But honestly, file the paperwork. Don't be the face-to-face person or the first person that they come in contact with when they're dealing with the situation. Okay, that's just that. On the personal side of allyship, I want to say the number one thing you can do is please don't make this about, you know, if they love themselves, if they value themselves, if they have self-esteem, you sound ignorant. This isn't about that. This is about survival. This is about, there are other aspects at play for you to boil it down simply to one thing. And the sad thing about that is, and I talk about that a lot, and I don't know if I've mentioned it here or not, but I feel like as a society, we establish our values and our framework for things as the measure, as the measuring stick, and then we judge according to our measuring stick. Right. And so if your measuring stick says that if you had this much love, you'd leave because this is what I think, then you're not going to ever really be an ally. And it's not about you helping her. It's about you telling her or him why they are not living their life the way that you think they should live it. And then you are judging that based on what you think. And then you're going to apply your own value to their actions. That's so wrong. Like, so wrong. And I get it, because like, there are so many times where you could be told like, oh, you're being judgmental. I feel like that's the difference. There is a right and wrong way for everything. I respect your right to do it how you want to do it. But I'm not going to tell you it's right because I'm in love with you, or because I love you, or because you're my friend or my cousin or my sister or whatever. That's different than because of what I think, I'm going to treat you and ascribe things to your situation based on how I think and how I feel. Those are two different things. I think the latter is the judgmental piece. If you're not supposed to drive on a red light and you drive, and I'm like, yo, that's reckless. Oh, you're so judgmental. No, it's not. There's a right and a wrong way to do a thing. And so I need you guys, if you're allies, to really hold that piece, okay? If you are going to be an ally too, you have to let her lead and define what that looks like. You can't come in and say, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. This is what it looks like. No, you can come in with what you can do. Like, hey, this is my capacity. This is what I have to offer you. This is what I have to help you with. But you can't come in and trying to set the parameters for her escape, for her survival, anything like that. Because then again, it's not about her. It's not about her children. It's not about the considerations that she have to make long after you're gone. Because there isn't an ally in my life that's going to be there for me the way that I would be there in that situation. I have to live out that situation after you are gone, when you are asleep, when you are at work, when you don't have capacity to deal with my situation. And because of that, it's going to be very important that she leads and defines what your allyship looks like and the actions that's taken and how they're taken. Even if you don't really care about or hold or understand why she's moving the way she's moving, you should respect it. And the same thing goes with the things that she feels like she has to do to be safe, right? Someone today, someone close to me gave out my address without my permission, and I instantly forgot myself. One, because in the hood, you don't know who, and I don't want to be a robbery victim or anything like that. No, I'm not in the hood, but that thought life forever stays with me because it's what I use to protect myself. It's part of my parameters and my boundaries. If you have my address, it's because I gave it to you. It's not because you invited her and whomever to come over here, right? And so if she has something that you think is seemingly small or not a big deal, but to him or her, it is a big deal, you have to respect that. You have to respect that. And you have to be able to hold the things that she cares about to account, right? Like, you can't just, you know, move however you want to move if you want to be an ally. And the last thing I want to say, and I've reiterated it at every point, is that allyship is about her outcomes. It's about how she wants to escape it. It's about her walking into her life and her purpose to achieve her assignment for her life. It's not about you. It's not about what you think about her situation. Quite frankly, no one's asking. If you are there to be help, to be assisting to her, that's great. But again, it's not about you. There's going to be things that happen that you don't understand or respect, and if your allyship and support hinges on that, I ask you to look at your capacity. Where there's a hinge, there should be a reevaluation of your allyship, of your capacity to help her. And what I mean is, there are certain things that I can do, but if you're hurting kids, I don't have the capacity for that. My help for you hinges on if there's a child being hurt. Anything before that, I got you. When a kid starts getting hurt, I don't care if it's emotionally, verbally, whatever. You've reached the contingency for me and I need to step back. And the reason why that matters is because she or he is really in a serious situation. Some situations could be life or death. And if you are in there with the conditions in place and that can affect her life or death, you need to be real about that. You really need to be real about that, and you need to be real about that with them, okay? And so I know that this was probably a lot for some, and I really try to not be graphic. I try to not be hurtful to you, my listeners, especially if you have survived domestic violence. But I felt like it was important to at least talk about the incidents that kind of contributed to it. Because it really is the foundation for the conversation. even the survivor in me now still is like, oh, it could have been this. And his family, I don't know if they have anything to say about me. I am friends with his sisters on Facebook, and like most of the time they're, you know, we like each other's posts if we see them and stuff. Because at some point you do have to move on. But it's like, I don't think they say anything about me, but even if they could say like, oh my God, I remember one time we had this barbecue and my kitchen, I had one counter and it was tore up, and it was so like, oh, he's like, don't worry about it. Ain't nobody gonna see it anyway. And then the sisters came over and it's like, oh my God, they could say that. That still wouldn't warrant me getting kicked in the face. That still wouldn't warrant you talking about me, disrespecting me, threatening me. Like, it doesn't. And so, you know, I don't know the space in which, and they probably will never hear it. If they do, you know, we could process whatever. But that was another thing too. I didn't want this to really revolve around the abuse or him. I really wanted to just give a foundation for the allyship, for tips of the trade to really help with that. And so, you know, I just want you to know, if you're listening to this and you're a survivor, that it does take a lot of times to get out. I tried to leave several times. Some research says it takes 7 up to 10 times to leave. And so I just want to encourage you to be safe. I want to encourage you to like reach out. If we can help you here at the show, we can. But just know that you genuinely have an after this. God did not put you here for this. You were not born for this. Allah, I don't know, whomever, you were not created to be the brunt of someone else's issues and punches and hurtful things. Like, that's not what you're here to do. And I know you may fear that you can't survive without this person, or, you know, for some places they may, or some relationships, that other person may control the money or the resources, and there's ways to deal with that. But I encourage you to start thinking about a way that you can get out so you can survive, so you can thrive. Your life is not over. You have every right to have the life that you see for yourself and to have it safely. So keep working on you. Keep healing. Keep going to the therapy. Keep praying. Keep journaling. And that can help to keep you, to have you a strong container for all the things that you have to hold while you start to think about your exit. So I thank you for listening with me. You know, at this show, we really deal with where, you know, resilience, where life and resilience intersect. And this is one of those intersections that I felt was appropriate to talk about, especially in light of October being Domestic Violence Month. So I'm going to keep this a short show today just to give space for a Selah moment, for a point of reflection, and really just to not make it so heavy. Thank you to my kids for allowing me to share that. Just, you know, praying for you and us that this does not have any reverberating effects as we continue, you know, in this thing. And make sure you share this, you know, with anyone that could help, or anyone that provides services, especially child welfare. Oh my Lord, as a caseworker, and I know it's going to end the show, but I just want to say, as a caseworker, that is the most damaging view you could have, is that if she loved herself, she would. If she cared about those kids, she would. She cares about them kids more than you will ever know. And she is going to endure his abuse until she can get her kids safely away. And you have to hold every benefit of the doubt when you come into contact with a parent who's in a DV relationship. Okay, IPV, whatever the acronym or the abbreviations are now. But give her the benefit of the doubt. And quite frankly, and this is truly, I promise you guys, this is the last thing I'll say. It's not for you to evaluate her self-love. Huh? It's not for you to evaluate her self-worth. It's not for you. If you hear yourself saying that, then you know you've left your assignment and your purpose. Your purpose is to keep the kids safe. Your assignment is to empower her to do it. So hopefully that is a rubric. That is a flag. That is a hold up. I need to check myself if you hear that. And if there's any way that I can be of a support, even to providers, I'm totally down to do that. But in the meantime, again, this is your girl, Deanna J. Speaks, here on Life After. Almost knocked over a cup, but it's all good. And we're so excited to just get any feedback from this. So thank you for joining us at the place where life and resilience intersect. And we'll see you next time. Peace.